Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
All right. Very excited to have this guest today. You guys know him as Mr. Wonderful. You've seen him many times on Shark Tank, of course. And now he is starting a new series on CNBC called Money Court. It's Kevin O'Leary. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I'm a big, big fan of yours. Of course, I've, like many people, been mesmerized many times by the endless cycle of Shark Tank and airs 24/7, 365, whether you're walking through an airport, a lobby, at home, it never stops. It's incredible. It's an incredible show that is now in your, 13th season or something like that?
Yeah, we're in the middle of the 13th season right now.
It's really an incredible success that, I don't know, people just can't get enough of. I likened it to a little bit of when it first started, when American Idol first started, you would watch people being like, I want to be a singer. And then you'd watch them sing and you're like, either they are terrible and you get some joy out of that, or you're like, oh my God, this person's incredible. And there's something about watching people pitch successful business ideas to, or pitch ideas to successful business people and hearing what kind of feedback you give them that I don't know why, but obviously a lot of people feel that way. It's exciting. It's exciting to either see them go down in flames or get you guys to compete and start wanting to invest in that business.
Well, it's really hard to get financial freedom singing. If you get a hit product and you sell hundreds of millions of dollars of it, which happens all the time on Shark Tank these days, you're free. And so we are the essence of the American dream. And I think that's what I've learned after all of this over a decade of watching. And I must say something, you know, that's really remarkable. Just because you think it's a hot product doesn't mean it's so. You need a portfolio approach, because my biggest winners were ones I thought weren't going to work, and vice versa.
Is that really true? Your biggest winners, you weren't even convinced that were going to be that successful?
Yeah, I took a flyer because I liked the person or the team or the woman or the man pitching it. And the thing ends up making me millions of dollars. You just don't know. And that's why you can't stop watching it. It really is. It's a combination of luck, timing, marketing skills, social media. All of these things have to come together to make a product really work or a business. And we've learned that. I mean, that's why, you know, every day in my portfolio of over 34 companies now, there's something euphoric going on a few of them and catastrophic on the other. It's like a passion play. The phone is ringing. I'm getting emails. Oh, we're going out of business. The other ones just said we're being acquired for 10 times revenue. You just don't know. And that's what I love about it.
Yeah, I imagine that's a pretty exciting thing. Well, how do you handle the catastrophic news? Like when you get news that like, look, this business is in the shitter and, you know, you put your money into it. Like, I guess I feel like most people would be like, don't get too emotional, but isn't it almost impossible to stay without emotion when you get those kinds of calls?
Well, I want to assure you, when I lose money, I cry like a baby. Okay, I really do. Because it's so hard to make it. And it doesn't matter how much you have, when you kill it that way, it's just really stressful. But the way I look at it is, look, it's going to happen. Some percentage, even in venture capital, you know, if you can look back since the 1950s, you're only going to get a 2 out of 10 that are really going to work, and they're going to pay for the other 8 dogs you invested in. But on Shark Tank, we do way better because we have hundreds of millions of people watching the show. And so at the end of the day, after through syndication and international distribution, products get distributed worldwide as people get to know them. It's the most powerful 8 minutes of consumer advertising you can get. That's why everybody wants to bring their idea to Shark Tank.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that would be, you know, which one I remember, by the way, sometimes, you know, these things, I don't know if you'll remember this one. You probably will because you invested in it, but it was many seasons ago, but I remember watching this pitch and watching you, you know, compete for it. It was a guy who had come up with a Play-Doh that was, maybe it was like for like some type of like had an ingredient missing that no one had thought to do. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
And
I do.
And then he wanted to give you, he had agreed to give you 49%, and you were like, nah, 51%, because I need to be able to, you know, make decisions on this thing. And he ended up going for it. And I thought it was a brilliant idea, a concept. I don't know whatever happened with the company.
You know, products like that aren't companies yet. They're just products. And that's why I need 51%, because I know at the end of the day, a lot of people have great ideas, but you need executional skills with great ideas. You can't just have a great idea. They're a dime a dozen. Executional skills are really hard to find. So when you combine executional skills with a great idea, then you have a business. But that doesn't happen that often. So when I see somebody, there's a great product, no distribution, no idea what to do with it, maybe I'll take a flyer, but I'm not going to let them manage it. I mean, look, you got to take the, you have to tell the truth on these situations. I'm the only shark that tells the truth. Everybody else lies to everybody trying to make them feel better. Uh-huh. And they call me the mean shark. It's ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah. Hey man, I'm on your side 1,000%. Now, the new show, Money Court, you're going to be flanked by a trial attorney and a former public defender and judge, and you're taking real people's money issues and hearing them out and making a decision, giving them advice, and having the other two attorneys weigh in on it. What do you find is the most common money issue for most people? Because money is obviously such a huge factor in all of our lives. We live in this capitalistic world and society. So money is a thing that people argue about. People, you know, break up over, people get together over. It's a huge thing. So what is like the most common issue you find when it comes to money?
So the problem, if you think about categorically, small business in America represents 65% of job creation. Mostly these are family businesses that were started sometimes by the existing generation or maybe the previous generation, and they've grown to 30, 40, 50, 60, $100 million in sales, and they're successful. But within families, there's always ego and tension, always. There's the brother, the sister, the mother, the cousin, whatever. And, you know, even though the business is really successful, these emotional aspects surface every once in a while and cause a lot of chaos. And it's sort of the way I tell everybody this is to think about this. If you are unable to fire your own mother, you shouldn't run the family business, because you've got to think about the business first. It is what sustains everybody, all the employees, all the customers, all the bank loans, all the investors. You got to take care of the business. You can't let yourself get caught up in a huge legal battle with your brother. What a dumb idea. But it happens all the time. And that was the essence of what Money Court is. And so what we tried to do is, first of all, break the logjam that's been created during the pandemic. There are tens of thousands of cases waiting to get into court because the courts haven't really been open during the pandemic. So they've decided to go to arbitration. Now, you can choose who arbitrates your case. And what's really interesting about this, when we started casting it, because these are real cases, the real litigation, real money here. They've got to sign a contract that they will abide by my rendering, by my decision. And many of the people said, you know, I don't really like that Mr. Wonderful, but I trust him. How about that? And that just shows you telling the truth is not a bad thing, because at least they think you'll render the truth. I've got Katie Fang with me, who's absolutely spectacular. She's a trial attorney. I've got Anna Pozzo, and she's amazing too. Anna knows exactly what it's like to sit on a bench, because that's what she did. She can smell BS a mile away. And when it comes to contract law, you know, Katie Fang's like a weasel. She'll rip your flesh if she smells anything wrong with what you're telling her. And I love it. I've got these fantastic legal advisors, but ultimately I render the decision.
So you make the final decision. I saw a clip, I think it's from the new show, or maybe it was from an interview that you did promoting it or something, where you said that it was your take on when family asks for money. In this clip, you said, you know, when family asks for money, I have like a steadfast rule that I stick to, which is if I'm giving you the money, I'll give you the money and it's not a loan. You don't have to give it back, but you never ask me for money again.
It's worked for me. I constantly get asked for money, and with my own family, and this happens anytime one family member has a windfall, it's my advice to them. Everybody's going to come crawling out of the woodwork saying, look, I want to open a bowling alley, a restaurant, a disco. I want to buy a truck, whatever it is. Uh-huh. And if you get yourself into a situation where you have family members owing you money, which you know with certainty they're never going to pay you back, right, you're way better to say, look, I'll lend you this. No, not as a loan. It's a gift. It's yours. I was very fortunate. I'm gifting this money. Never call me for money again. That's our unwritten contract. And I've lived through that many times. And I'm able to go to Thanksgiving dinner every year and smile at everybody. And they smile at me. We have no tension. We have an understanding.
And has anyone who ever borrowed or taken that money and been like, all right, thanks, have they ever tried to hit you up again?
Of course. But we have an agreement. We have an agreement.
No, that was the deal.
Yeah, look, you know, everybody's life is full of complications, and that's just the nature of family. There's always the black sheep. There's always the story. There's always the mother-in-law. I mean, that's what makes life interesting. Right. And there's never a day that isn't boring. But, you know, I've got a lot of CEOs that I invest in. I've got a lot of operating companies. I have my own operating company. I try and keep a balance in life. But at the same time, I realize how it works. You've got to be transparent. You've got to be honest. And sometimes people can't stand the truth.
Well, Kevin, let me ask you something. I do pretty well. And I make a good living. And my mom keeps hitting me up for shit, man. Like, it's constant. It's luggage. It's trips to casinos. I just bought her a freaking MacBook so she can just play bridge. Like, it never ends. Do I just keep buying her stuff because she's going to die someday?
Yeah. If it's your mother, you got to keep buying her stuff.
Okay. So that's the one. I mean,
one rule. You can't mess with your mother. It's bad karma, okay, man.
But everybody else, I can tell them to.
Yeah. They're not your mother.
Hit the bricks. Yeah. Okay, cool. Just wanted to make sure on that. She's going to love this portion of the show. So now I read a thing about your investment philosophy about age versus holding stocks and bonds. I wanted to know, do you have an opinion on real estate? Do you believe that having real estate as an investor is a good idea, worthwhile? Or like, see, this is my take on this before you tell me. I feel like people are drawn to the types of investing they're familiar with. So I have friends who their families, they were raised in real estate families. In other words, the family owns homes and apartments and condos that they rent out. So as the kids get older, that's what they invest in. My father was a stockbroker. So it was like the market is what I'm familiar with and I feel comfortable with. But I've also thought of diversifying in the way of getting like into an investment property. And I'm wondering if you think that is wise or not.
Yeah, I do have a lot of real estate in my portfolio. But I'll tell you a rule that my mother taught me, who is not a, you know, analyst or a portfolio manager, but she did incredibly well during her life. Simple rule. She said, never put more than 5% into any one position and never more than 20% in any one sector, including real estate. And her theory was that no matter what happens, if something blows up on you and it's only a 5% position, it can't wipe you out. Where people get killed, particularly in real estate, particularly in commercial real estate, which has gone under a lot of pressure because people's work patterns are changing as a result of this last year and a half of pandemic. This is not a great asset anymore because basically some percentage of the work population never wants to go back to headquarters. Yeah. And as a result, you're seeing all kinds of buildings that used to be AAA supreme in Boston, New York, Detroit, you know, Florida, Miami, you name it. These buildings are, you know, 15, 20% empty right now. And everybody's saying, don't worry, it'll get back to normal. No, it isn't going to go back to normal. Some percentage of the population, particularly people working accounting, logistics, and, you know, compliance, those are the ones that sit in those cubicles. They have no interest in going back. And if you can't provide them, you know, a way to work from their homes in the suburbs, or they're taking care of their kids and the elderly parents, they'll just work for somebody else. And so I think at the end of the day, we're going through a change. So I'm not really as excited about real estate, commercial real estate, as I used to be. I still own a lot of residential. I'm okay with that, but not commercial. I want a breather on that. Imagine if you owned a movie theater chain, how screwed you'd be now.
Oh my God. I know. I mean, like I think about the, you know, that lawsuit that was all in the news, recently, Scarlett Johansson against, Disney Plus for her movie that came out. And, you know, as somebody who I'm a comedian and performer, I automatically side with Scarlett. But then also when I heard the details, one line of theirs told me how full of shit they were, which is that, you know, she had a theatrical window that her movie could come out in, and that was in the contract. And then they put out a statement that said she didn't take into account the all the pressures and the catastrophic effect of COVID-19. It's like, yeah, that doesn't get you out of the contract though, man. But I mean, I understand why their position is we needed to stream it as well. But I still feel like it's not a legit case on their part.
Yeah, I mean, look, I look at those numbers almost every week because we have businesses that support movie theaters, and they are down 60% year over year. The box offices are abysmal. It's a bloodbath on every release. People don't want to go back to those places, not just because COVID, because they're used to streaming. They spent a year and a half streaming anything they want. Yeah. You don't want to release your movie the way people want to watch it. Too bad. Lose money. That's exactly what's happening to these people. I think they made James Bond 5 years ago and they're still waiting to release it.
I think
I'm not going to a theater to see that. If you can't serve it up to me in my basement with my own popcorn and my own can of pop, forget it. I don't care. I'll watch something else. That's the new reality. And you've got to listen to what the customer wants. Look, if she wants to get into litigation with Disney, good luck. They're not easy to fight with.
That's true. I mean, I don't know how that'll end up, but point being,
well, let me make a prediction. Not well for her.
Okay. And is that prediction just based on the giant that Disney is and the heavy hitters they'll bring?
You know, I've been working for Disney for almost 15 years and Sony, and I learned to respect the way they run their business and the way they license their content and the way they work with their talent. It's a mutual respect that's required. I would never litigate the hand that feeds me. I would go sit down and try and work it out in private quarters. They would respect me for that. I remember when I was negotiating my contract for Shark Tank in season 3, and I didn't want to have an agent. And I went to see the then president of ABC, the studio that was putting it on the air, owned by Disney. And he said, Kevin, can we have a frank conversation? Can we be honest and transparent with each other? And I said, yeah, I negotiate my own deals. I don't want to pay an agent 10%. He said, yeah, you do. And you're going to. Because if it's you and me negotiating your deal, there's going to be blood on this carpet. It'll be yours. And I don't want that to happen because I have to work with you for the years ahead. I would rather draw blood from your agent who has to work with me every day for the rest of his life across a wide range of products. And who knows, you may benefit from the fact that he'll horse trade you. You're just meat. You're just talent. It's time you learned that here in Hollywood. And I went, whoa, you got to be kidding. I'm just meat. He said, yeah. Now you're expensive meat. And I met my new agent that afternoon at the SLS Hotel. His name was Jay Suris. We've been together a lot of years, 10 years. He made me a ton more money, a ton. And the reason was he was able to horse trade assets across all the studios. That's how Hollywood works, and it's never going to change. But you never sue the studio.
Hey, Scarlett, might want to rethink this one. Shit. Well, for the record, I didn't sue you, Disney. Scarlett did. Now, let me ask you this, because you're a big baller and you have properties and you have all types of holdings. You're a wine enthusiast. You've done it, you know. So I always want to ask people who have achieved great success, what is like a secret baller thing? Like, everybody knows about private planes and yachts, but is there something that as you became more successful, you discovered, you're like, I didn't even know this was a thing? It doesn't have to be a product. It can be a service. Is there anything that you've been blown away that exists that you've discovered since you became so successful?
I have this philosophy that I've learned through experience. And I must say, I look back, you know, at those moments that didn't mean anything at the time, but you think and remember them now. I was graduating from business school in the last week, and they had guest lectures all the time, kind of like that Harvard thing where you're sitting in a big theater and they walk in a guy, the CEO of a company, whatever, and you listen to him. Maybe the cohort had about 160 people in it. And I remember my guy to my right that had been there with me for 2 years named Barry Nicole. Barry and I were close friends. And they walk in this guy. I'll never forget this. You know, I've forgotten everything else in business school, but I never forgot this moment. He walks in, he stands in the middle of the theater, but he doesn't say anything. He just starts looking around at each of us, row after row. It was creepy. And it was dead silence. You could hear a pin drop. And he said, you guys think you're such hot shit that you're just about to get out of business school and you're going to rip the world apart. And you know what you're doing. You know nothing. You have no experience. Two thirds of you are going to fail. You're going to lose your careers and have to find something else. The other third are going to struggle for years before they figure it out. And I leant over to Barry and I said, what an asshole this guy is. But you know what? He was 100% right. He was talking about the value of experience. And the reason I tell the story is I'm that guy. When I teach at Harvard today or MIT or Notre Dame or Temple, I'm that guy. I walk in there and say the same thing and I tell the exact same story. The point is you got to remember those things as you build your own experience up. And now what I've learned is you need yin and yang in your life. You need business, the hard focus of the binary aspect, the black and white, making or losing money. But you also have to have the chaos of the arts or music or painting or something else. And for me, that's guitar. I play a lot of guitar, play in some bands. Mm-hmm. I collect watches. I have a massive watch collection. I know all the large collectors around the world in the royal families and all of the people that are really into this stuff and the watchmakers. I love it. It's chaotic. It's crazy. But it's the balance. I don't need any more money. I just need to keep what I've got. But, you know, I walk in with another watch and my wife says to me, hey, asshole, what do we need another watch for? Are you out of your mind? And I say, yes, we need this watch. It's one of a kind. And now I own it. She said, how stupid. You can't even wear, if you wore a new watch three times a day for the rest of your life, you still have too many watches. You would never get through them all. It's true. It's true.
So, all right, let's talk about watches then, because I always found that I always liked it. I mean, from when I was a kid, I always liked the look of either on some people you'd see the classic leather strap. And some people I love seeing, you know, like that traditional steel sub look that became so like I love that look. There we go. What do we got? Is that what we're in here?
Yeah, white-faced Daytona, black, you know, dial. That's the classic steel white-faced Daytona with a red band, my signature red band.
The band is nice, man. Yeah. Are you a fan of like a Richard Mille? Do you get like those and you get some of those crazy ones too?
Yeah, you know, right now I would say, you know, if we're going to go down the rabbit hole on watches, there are two living watchmakers that have reached Picasso status. Mm-hmm. Roger Smith and F.P. Journe. And they make watches by appointment. Journe is a legend, a living legend. Imagine if you could have a Michelangelo be alive and come and paint a dial for you. That's who he is. He only makes 900 pieces a year. There are thousands of people waiting to get one from him. They appreciate by 400% the minute they walk out the store. God. If you ever flip one, you never get to buy another one from him. It's, you really have to prove you're a collector to join the Journe Society. It's crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. But, and I've got a lot of Journes. And, you know, to me, it has nothing to do with telling time. Somebody said to me, how can you even tell the time on that watch? I said, I don't. This is a piece of art. It's a piece of art and it's appreciated in value just like art does. So my watch collection is up 114% in the last 12 months. I have them stored all around the world and I'm working on a really interesting new deal that I'm funding to create watch NFTs so that, you know, wow. If there's a one of, yeah, I mean, to me, I mean, I, if there's anybody going to do it, it's going to be me. Nobody knows the collectors like I do. Nobody knows the brands like I do. And I can hire tech guys, which I'm doing. I'm going to call this thing the Wonder Trust. Watch for it.
Okay. Yeah. So NFTs, I mean, it's, you know, it was something that I don't even know if it was in the lexicon a year or a little more than that ago. And now it's nonstop. It's all you hear about is all the possibilities of NFTs. So you're obviously a proponent of that. Yeah.
Well, let me give you a reason why. I have a friend, let's call him Bill. These collectors don't like to, they're very quiet about their pieces. I went to his home recently and with a lube, I looked at a one of a kind piece, only one in the world. Maybe five other people have ever viewed it personally. I'm one of those five. And I said to Bill, look, Bill, can I get a picture of this dial just so I can have it? He said, no, I've never let anybody photograph it for obvious reasons. That's when the whole idea hit. And I said, Bill, why don't we partner up and create an NFT company so that you can create the 001 NFT, which authenticates your piece. That's given, stays with the piece for the rest of its life. But then you authorize another 10 serialized 01 through 10, and you let me buy one of those so I can actually own an image, the real thing, the one of a kind dial. Yeah. Yeah. And what's the price? Auction it. I'll pay whatever the world's willing to pay for it. That's where I'm going with this idea.
I like the idea a lot. Are you a fan of Pateks too?
Oh yeah. Patek is like, you know, Patek is, if you think about the major brands that you can't go wrong with, Audemars Piguet, Patek, and then, Rolex for sure. I mean, Rolex makes millions of watches, but certain Rolexes are the ones you want to go after. Sure. But then you've got the micro brands like Ming. I have a one of a kind Ming. No one's ever heard of Ming. Unless you're a watch collector, then you go out of your mind to see this watch. It was made for Ming. It's a Ming for Ming. And his production manager was a huge Shark Tank fan. I reached out, it's in Singapore, and I said, listen, I've heard a rumor that Ming's making a Ming for Ming. He said, yeah, it's a one of a kind. I said, I'll buy it. And he said, I got to talk to Ming and maybe Ming will want you to have it. And he did. I have the only one.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
I'm giddy like a teenager here. Now I'm going to turn that into an NFT.
I didn't realize that Patek did the thing that, I mean, you see from different types of manufacturers, especially like high-end luxury things, where you go in the store and you're like, I want to get the, what's the green,
The Nautilus. You're talking about the 5711, which just got, you know what happened? The 5711, the classic blue dial, was the entry level Patek.
Right.
And it exploded. I mean, maybe you bought it for 30 grand. The minute they canceled it, I think it went to 150,000. Now, I'm lucky to have a 5711, but they also have the last of the 5711, which is a green faced version of the same Nautilus. And grown men are weeping to get one.
Yeah, I love that watch, but I didn't realize that when I was in this store, they go, oh, you have to own other ones for us to even like get you that one. I was like, oh,
let me tell you something. The chance that you'll own that watch is zero. Just cool. To set you up. You're going to have to deal with all the collectors around the world that have millions of dollars of Pateks ahead of you. That's the thing you got to understand. Patek understands the value of their collectors.
Yeah.
And there's something else you should know. Patek has a relationship with royal families all around the world. They don't talk about it, but certain royal families, when a child turns 18, what do you think they get? A one of a kind Patek.
Wow. So when you think of your collection, And like the, you know, the magnitude and the value of it, ultimately, as you get older, is it something you go, I want to leave this to my kids? Is it something you'd want auctioned off? Is it something you wanted shown like a museum style? What's like your ultimate dream for your watch collection?
Yeah, I've been asked that so many times, including from Phillips, which is the world's number one watch auctioneer. They do every fall a huge charity auction, which I participate in, and also they auction watches. I've told my family that's always rating, including my wife, who loves to wear all my watches, and my daughter and son. Mm-hmm. I say, listen, guys, all of these are coming in my coffin with me. I'm not leaving anything. And the reason I'm going to need all this is I'm going to a place where it's a really, really long time we're talking about, and I'm going to need really good watches.
Yeah.
And my wife said to me, don't worry, Kev, I'll bury them in the case. Don't worry.
So your collection is hundreds of watches, I'm assuming, or maybe.
You know what I've learned? Because I've had two heists over the decades. And I no longer disclose how many or where. And I have a very complex inventory control system, a really complex insurance system in place. But that's why I'm so motivated, along with several other collectors, to start this NFT company, because all of us that have these massive collections are going to create these NFTs in association with giant insurers, because we want the manufacturer to authenticate our serial number, and we want the insurer to insure based on location. But you know, my watches, they'll never be a heist again, because they're in so many different countries and so many different vaults all over the place.
Well, congrats on that. You know, my one of my agents worked out like a really good deal for me on something, and then when I was talking to him, he was like, how happy are you with this deal? I go, very happy. And he goes, cool, you're going to buy me a watch. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, I'm a collector. So that's what you're going
to
do.
Not so easy to get watches these days. As an asset class, they've exploded to the upside. Even for example, recently, a standard $6,000 Rolex, the entry level Rolex, they put out a bunch of colored faces. One of them was a coral red face on a $6,000 perpetual. Mm-hmm. And Kanye was seen wearing it at a basketball game and gave it to his soon to be divorced wife, I guess, Kim Kardashian, on television. The watch exploded. It just, every woman wants this 41 millimeter entry level coral red. It's just insane now. That's the kind of thing that happens.
I was in Vegas a few weeks ago and, you know, walking through one of the nice casinos and they have every type of store. And I went into the, like one of the high end jewelry stores, just, you know, looking at watches. They had, their inventory was abysmal. Like they had like two of these and two of these. And I'm like, where else do you have? Like,
this they don't have any watches in retail. There are none. You're going to have to deal with your representative. And, you know, Rolex is sold out. Patek sold out. Audemars Piguet sold out. Even Omega sold out. Everything's sold out.
Okay. Well, good to know, guys. You got to know someone to get a watch. Now, let me ask you about big, because we're talking about big ticket purchases. One thing that, a lot of different couples, families talk about is when there's a big purchase made, is there a discussion? Personally, I'll just buy something and show up with it. And then my wife's like, how much was that? And I'll be like, it was this much. And then she'll be like, oh my God. And I don't talk about it ahead of time. But some people have lengthy discussions about whether or not a purchase should be made. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation because I wrote a book once that I did a lot of research on called Men, Women, and Money. I ended up writing three of them on this topic. And in that first book, I thought it would take me a couple of months to write. It took me over a year and a half. I did a lot of research with divorce attorneys and I found out something incredible. It doesn't matter what, you know, economic level you're talking about. 50% of unions break up between 5 and 7 years, not for infidelity. Most marriages can, you know, survive infidelity. It changes them somewhat, but they can survive. What they can't survive is financial stress. The majority of breakups have to do with inconsistencies in one couple's spending habits versus another that puts the family under financial stress. That's why the union breaks up. It's just too hard to deal with. Because really, a family at the end of the day, after 7 years, is a business. You basically both have to have common goals. You have to save commonly. You can't get into debt too much. And sometimes people are incompatible. They never did any due diligence going into the marriage about that. And so really, you know, when I tell people, look, if you're dating and you're going on your third date, time to start some financial due diligence about your potential partner. In fact, you're getting together for a third time must mean something. And so, you know, it's worth asking. I love the romantic part of any relationship, but at the end of the day, If you're losing money and you're putting your partner under tremendous stress and you can't support your kids and your home, you're going to get divorced.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, I feel like the probably the most stressful time in my own marriage was those early years when we were struggling the most, right? Because you're just, it keeps you up at night. How are we going to pay for this? You know?
Yeah. No, I remember when I got married, I couldn't even afford any dinner for our guests or anything. We just ordered in pizza. And I said, listen, stay tuned. I think I'll figure something out. We'll have a party in a few years when I can afford it, which is basically what we did. But it was really tough for the first 4 years.
Yeah. And those, I mean, for us, God, I would say the first few years were absolutely the hardest. And we were living in a terrible neighborhood and in a horrible apartment. And, you know, even like when I sold something like this web thing and I got a check for it. It was like the day before a bill came from the city for like a new tax. And I was like, oh shit. And it was, you know, thousands of dollars. And like, it felt like you couldn't win. But,
you know, on the other hand, if you can make it and you're with the same, you know, partner you had all those years, that's equity you've built in your relationship. I'm still married to my wife, the one that we had no money, and she's never been impressed with money. She just doesn't care. And so, you know, it's not what makes her happy. She just wants to take care of the family. And, you know, it's really refreshing actually to find that out. I know she didn't marry me for money because they didn't have any. So that's good to know.
Yeah, that is good to know. Speaking of the how things started, when you were mentioning, you know, business school, I always hear people weigh in on, particularly very successful people, and you'll hear varying opinions. I feel like you hear the loudest. A lot of times, successful people will talk about how school, particularly, you know, the high end Ivy League educations. Some successful people say like, oh, it's meaningless and a waste of time. And I'm wondering, as somebody who went to business school and is now very successful, what your opinion is on higher education, basically, for business people?
Yeah, I actually have been asked this many times in the past and have gotten myself in a lot of trouble with the institutions I teach at, because I go back particularly to institutions that are graduating cohorts of engineers, because a third of an engineering class is going to come out with new ideas, and I like to see the deals before the venture capitalists do. And I'm always intrigued, you know, when I tell them my truth. I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, post-secondary education in a discipline like engineering or psychology or, you know, certain medical verticals, yeah, you have to do that because you have to get accredited by the association that lets you get a license to practice. But business school is different. I'm not sure that, you know, people remember anything from business school. And I'm not sure that actually matters. The people that I've made the most money with, many of them never finished high school. And so what makes a great entrepreneur has nothing to do with education other than the street smarts they get being educated by the real world. But I'll tell you what business school is good for.
Okay.
All the people that I went to school with, I don't know how many decades ago now, I don't remember a single thing about what they taught us, but I remember them. And they are all over the world now. And I have a special bond with them because I actually was with them in school for 2 years. I can call any of them up, and most of them are running banks or, you know, financial institutions or manufacturing facilities all around the world. And if I need something, I just call them up, say, look, I'm doing a financing for $300 million on a deal. Can you send me some of your bankers to look at this thing? And they say, yeah, sure. I mean, I know who you are. You've got street cred with me. And that's really the value of it. It's not, you're creating a experience with others that, you know, that only you have. And those relationships are very, very powerful. Some go into government. I find them everywhere. And so we stay in touch with each other just because we experienced those 2 years together in a very tough time. None of us had money. We were working like hell to get through it. We graduated. That's the value. And now the professors who let me teach in their classes say, hey, dickweed, that's not what we like to say. And I said, I don't care. It's the truth. It's my truth. And so, but they still invite me back.
No, that's a really interesting point, because ultimately I think, you know, the older you get, you realize how valuable relationships are. And in any type of business, like even the business that I'm in with like comedy and podcasting and the stuff that we do, I mean, those relationships, those phone calls that I can make a lot of times are the things that lead to something happening. It's because I've known these people.
I would agree with that. I would also say something else has happened. You know, speaking of media and podcasting and celebrity and all that stuff. In the last 3 years, what I've noticed, and this is a very powerful trend that I think is never going to reverse, the intersection between social media, the media itself, and stock market capitalization has merged. You've seen what's happened with Robinhood and Reddit and these meme stocks. That's never going to change. If you're able to tell a story about a company and you're able to broadcast out, and this is, you know, proven by Shark Tank, actually, if you have the ability to reach millions of people, you have a different kind of power than anything in terms of what a company can do that no one knows. I mean, they can buy advertising, they can do all that stuff, but it's not the same. So when people come to me and say, look, will you be an investor in my company? You know, we'll give you stock options. I say, I'm not interested in that. I mean, you just want to trade my name and say that I somehow invested in your company with stock options, which we both know is complete bullshit. If you want me to be your partner, I'm going to buy a third of the company. You're going to give it to me in terms that I think are fair. And then if I like what you're doing, I'll blow you up bigger than you ever dreamt, which is what I do. And so, you know, I take my own money. I don't want anything for free. Same with watches. I don't take free watches from watch companies. I buy them so I don't owe anybody anything. I don't want to owe anybody anything. But the point is, I buy a third of the company and I make it grow.
Do you feel like when it comes to a lot of times when you're coming up, right? You think about a sum of money as being enough. And, you know, somebody might say like, oh, you know, you have no money. They go, oh, $1 million or whatever. And then you achieve that and you make many times more of that. People a lot of times look at people that have achieved success at a high level and they have, you know, more money than they think you could ever need or spend. And they go, why do you keep working? And I always think that it's because, well, A, like, what else are you going to do? But also because you get the thrill out of the deals and the competition and, you know, trying to make it work and seeing it work again. It's not so much that, like, oh, I have this much more money now, I can buy something. It's like being in the game.
Yeah. What I would say to that, I've tried retirement, you know, most, I've talked to many entrepreneurs that have had big liquidity events. I mean, mine was the classic start in the basement. 10 guys, one day we wake up, our company gets sold for $4.2 billion. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, we all showed up the next day back at the office saying, what do we do next? I mean, you know, we didn't know anything else except working. And even though I woke up and said, shit, I'm really rich. But it didn't change anything, but I decided, well, maybe I'd like to go around the world and visit every beach. Like, just, there's a project. Let's go visit every beach. The ones in Cambodia, Vietnam, north coast of Cyprus, all this stuff, which I did for 36 months. Was that ever boring? Like, I was going out of my mind. And so I just said, I got to get back in the game. I got to get back in the game. And so I just started doing deals again, not so much as an operator, but as an investor. And so, I did my stint as an operator, which is very hard work, and I respect that. But I tell all my CEOs today, the people that are successful do not pursue money for the greed of it. They're never successful if they try that. If you're after money because you're just greedy, you'll never have any. But if you have a real passion about a business, you'll wake up one day like I did saying, wow, how'd that happen? Because it's the pursuit of personal freedom that is what sets you free. It's that you're driving, you know, your business because you love it so much, you want to compete. And then one day it's worth a lot of money and somebody buys it. And that sets you free. And then you pursue the things that matter to you. And that's what I do. I'm very fortunate that every day I have this woman I work with named Nancy Chung, breaks up my day into blocks. And every week at the beginning of the week, I look at the week and I say, what's this over here on Thursday at 3? She says, yada, yada, yada. I said, I'm not doing that. I don't care who they are, or what they are. I don't care. I don't want to be rude. Tell them, no, I'm not doing it. It doesn't interest me. And, you know, it's my time. I'll cry if I want to. And I don't have to do it. And so I want everybody to get to that place. It's a very fulfilling place to be.
I think that's great advice. I know that people ask me about, you know, stand up, and I always tell them that the only thing I know for sure about achieving some success in that field is that you have to have a level of obsession about it, especially in the first, you know, 10 plus years. Like if what matters to you is having success in those years, I've never seen it work. It's just people that are in love with the process of writing and performing and getting on stage. And all those people that were obsessed and didn't care if they couldn't make rent, and all their friends were buying their first homes and all this stuff. And you go like, I don't give a shit. I love stand up. All those comics that I know are the ones who achieved success.
Yeah, that's a very dark profession. I had a chance to travel while shooting a documentary as a cameraman once with a group of stand-ups. A lot of drug addiction, a lot of alcoholism there.
Yeah, it's great.
It's a really tough business because you're on at night. You've got a lot of crazy people in the audience, and it just grinds on. Those clubs in LA and Chicago, been there, done that. To survive that, you've really got to have some kind of an instinct of,
you got to care so much about what's going on stage. I mean, because other people do succumb to the drugs and the alcohol and everything, all the temptations of it. But the ones who, like, I consistently go like, yep, that, you know, that person's totally made it. They cared so much. They were so obsessed with performing comedy that nothing else mattered. And then, you know, all of a sudden 10 and 20 years later, achieving all this great success, and people are, you know, it's funny when they go, he's an overnight success, or like, you just came out of nowhere. It's like, yeah,
I'm well
doing
aware
it for 20 years.
There are no overnight successes in the comedy space. It's brutal. You know, I've always thought that the best perch would be to get your own night show on television or something, which there's only five or six of. But the travel is, the food is terrible. The travel is brutal. I mean, it's
travel.
Just,
the travel is what kills you. It's like the like that old, I think it was Gene Hackman said it. I might be getting it wrong, but he said, I act for free. It's the waiting around that you pay me for, you know, on movie sets. And I feel the same way about stand-up. It's like, I'll do the show for free. It's all this brutal travel that I'd like to get paid for, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. That is tough. And, you know, as a result, I think you get to see other people's professions, and I enjoy doing that too. But at the end of the day, I'm very busy just supporting my companies, and I like all the different things they do. And I enjoy making television. And so maybe we'll do full circle here, because I got to leave in a few minutes. I'm on this press tour for Money Court, Wednesday night, 10 o'clock CNBC. I got to tell you, the casting of that show, and I've done a lot of work on television.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah. And we went through countless co-hosts, just, and it was the middle of pandemic, so we're doing it all remotely by Zoom, trying to find the chemistry to make it work. Just like in, you know, comedic presence, you got to have chemistry.
Yeah.
And Adepozo, the federal judge, the Cuban federal judge, was probably the last person we tested, because we were just at wit's end. We said, we got to pick from what we got, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember casting, we'd already chosen Katie. She was amazing. And I said, let's just try this one other, just to turn every stone over. And she was crazy good. And I went, whoa, like, you know, you just never know.
Yeah.
And boom, when that cast got together, and the reason I know this thing's going to be a FM hit, like a, or maybe I should say MF hit, like, I can't say it, but it's,
you want
know
me to say
I
it?
Mean. I'll say it. I know it's going to be a motherfucking hit. Here's why. Because I basically have made so much TV in my time that I've worked with crews, you know, with in every studio. But I did this one at the Telemundo studio, the brand new digital studio. The sound technicians, the lighting technicians, they've seen everything. They don't watch TV. They make TV for you. All the people that are in makeup and the catering and all that stuff. Yeah. When you're taping, they're not watching. I looked over to my right in the middle of the first case that we were shooting, which was a crazy case. And it was emotional, and people were just being ripped apart by this situation where a mother was suing her own daughter. It was a gut wrench.
Jesus.
And I looked over to my right, and everybody in the studio was glued to the line feed on one of the monitors, like 30 of them. They weren't even attending the soundboards anymore.
Yeah.
And I went, whoa. And when the break hit and the makeup girl came over to me, she said, you asshole, you should have given the daughter more. She was totally engaged.
Yeah.
And I knew, motherfucking hit. We got a hit here, because the people that are supposed to be making the TV are watching the TV. That's what I know. Watch it happen when it airs on Wednesday. I think this thing's going to be crazy.
All right. Yeah. It's a new 6-part series on CNBC called Money Court. Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Kevin O'Leary, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you, my friend. That was a great interview. Really enjoyed it. Thanks.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks, man.